So it's ready to go?
Yep.
Okay, so just to set the context, I thought I'd review what I think Mike was talking about, but I missed one of his lectures. So the general question we're looking into is how much topology do unitary TQFTs see? And the emphasis is on unitary here because, you know, all these results don't have much to say about non-unitary TQFTs, which might be the more interesting ones in higher dimensions. So if we're in at least four, you can find pairs of non-polymorphic or non-diffeomorphic manifolds with the same boundary, such that the vector that they give in the Hilbert space associated to their boundary is the same for all unitary TQFTs. So it's a difference in geometry that's invisible in principle, you know, could never be seen by any unitary TQFT. And the way this is proved is by looking at a universal theory. This is what Mike was talking about, and showing that, in fact, they're the same in the universal theory, so they must be the same in any particular example. In the particular case of n equals 4, well, you might think that, okay, we can find these pairs that are indistinguishable, but maybe they're very close, you know, the differences aren't important anyway. But it turns out, in dimension 4 at least, these sort of indistinguishable pairs capture most of the four manifold topology that you care about. I mean, I think in four manifold topology these days, we'd like to distinguish manifolds which are homeomorphic, in particular homotopy equivalent, but they're not diffeomorphic. And you could ask, does the unitary TQFT offer any hope of answering that question? The answer is no. If you have a pair of manifolds which are homotopy equivalent, in particular, they might be, you know, might be a four sphere and a potential fake four sphere or something like that, then their partition function in any unitary TQFT is going to be the same. So these are a couple of negative results, and a positive result in very small dimensions is that in dimensions n less than or equal to 2, if z of m 2 is equal to z, and then 2 for all unitary TQFT z, this is true if and only if the pair m comma y, I'm assuming again we've got the common boundary y, is homeomorphic to the pair n comma y. So not very exciting because it's you know, there's lots of ways of telling one and two manifolds apart, but add to that long list, you know, TQFTs. And so this leaves so in high dimensions there's no hope, in low dimensions it's easy, and so what's left over is dimension 3. And so what can we say about dimension 3? Well, one thing we can say is that the proof up here fails in dimension 3. In particular, that we have this Z, maybe I should put it in quotes, it's not exactly a TQFT, but this universal thing that Mike was talking about. If the universal invariant of M is equal to this universal invariant of N, that's true if and only if. These are three manifolds in this case. That's true if and only if M comma, you know, the pairs M and its boundary are homeomorphic to N. Its boundary. And so one question we could ask, that I don't know the answer to, is does the stronger statement C hold for n equals 3? So we've got so if we look at the universal theory, it says, yeah, in principle, maybe we can tell everything apart, but can you actually do it with a particular TQFT? And what I think the theme of what I'm going to be saying today is providing maybe some partial answers to this question, so that there is some positive statements about three-manifold topology that TQFTs see. And in the course of it, we'll be just looking at finite group TQFTs. So So what are these finite group TQFTs? And I'm going to be considering only the untwisted case, the simplest way of constructing them. So let G be a finite group. Oh, I should say that everything I'm saying here, I don't think I have the references, but there's Dijkgraaf and Witten. We're the first to consider these. Is this how you spell Dijkgraaf?
Yes.
Okay. And this is a paper, I think it was late 80s or early 90s. And then the approach I'm taking is a little bit closer to some work of Fried and Quinn. And the paper, I think, is on communications and math physics in 91, I think. Okay, so G is a finite group, and let's let curly P sub G of a manifold X. X is going to be, might be 1, 2, or 3 dimensional in this case. Be the set of all principal G bundles over X. Up to isomorphism, so isomorphism classes of principal G bundles. And the idea is we think of these as some kind of fields on M. You know, there's a more familiar idea, which I think was the starting point for Dijkgraaf and Witten, of, you know, fixing, say, a connected, simply connected Lie group and looking at the space of all connections on that and then doing some kind of path integral over such a thing. And you might ask, okay, what about the general Lie group? Well, one of the complications you run into in general Lie groups is you have disconnected Lie groups, and so the simplest disconnected Lie groups are finite groups. In this case, there's really no difference between a bundle up to isomorphism and a connection, you know, any such thing as a unique flat connection. So the motivation for Dijkgraaf and Witten was doing this kind of as a warm-up for general Lie groups. So we want to define our invariant Z sub G of, say, a 3-manifold. Let's assume it's closed for now. And actually, this works in any dimension, but I'm just going to, for simplicity, assume we're in 2 plus 1 dimensions. So this is going to be, instead of an integral, we have a finite sum overall bundles in space of all bundles of, well, we have instead what the measure is on the space, and it turns out that the right measure to choose is 1 over the number of automorphisms of the bundle P. And it turns out it's not too hard to see that this is also equal to 1 over the cardinality of G times the cardinality of the set of all homomorphisms from pi 1 of m into G. Sort of a counting argument. So that's what it is for closed manifolds, and I think what we'll spend part of the time doing today is justifying, you know, this factor here. You know, why is this the right measure, the convenient measure?
On the right-hand side of the equality, you don't have to divide out a homomorphism by its symmetry.
Right. Yeah. So if you think of this, in some sense, this space P of M, this space of all bundles is this set modulo G action. So if we look at each orbit. Let's see. So if the size of the orbit of some homomorphism rho times the size of the stabilizer of rho is equal to the size of G. And so, just plug that into here, you see that these, you know, the stabilizer is the same as the automorphisms of P. Okay, more generally, we want not just closed manifold invariants, but we'd like to consider manifolds with boundary. So if we have boundary of M is non-empty, and we are given some principal bundle Q over boundary of M, as I just say, Q lies into G connection with the boundary of M. Then we define Z of M with boundary conditions given by Q to be the sum over principal bundles over M such that P restricted the boundary of M is equal to Q, and 1 over, again, same measure, automorphisms of P. Now, it turns out if M is connected, then this is always 1. I guess I need to define more exactly what I mean, but it's automorphisms which restrict to the identity on the boundary. And if you know, every component of M, if M has no closed components, then there are no such things. So this will just be counting the number of extensions. So it's equal to the size set of all bundles of M such that P restricted boundary of M. Also notice that I think I'll leave it there for now. So if we like, we can think of Z of M, in the case where M has boundary, as a function from G bundles on boundary of M to the complex numbers. And then if we define a Hilbert space, V, say, for any two manifold Y, which I guess also it turns out that later in the subject, it's a bad idea to have, you know, this TQ of T is consisting of two different letters. We want to think of it more of as a representation than just. And so we just use Z, and then, you know, in computer science speak, Z is an overloaded function. So depending on what you plug into it, you get a different thing out. If you put a three-manifold into Z, you get a complex number, maybe a vector in some vector space. If you feed it a two-manifold, you get a Hilbert space. So what is this? Well, it's just a set of all functions from G bundles over Y into the complex numbers. And since I call it a Hilbert space, I need to tell you what the inner product is. Inner product of Q1 and Q2 is 0 if Q1 is not isomorphic to Q2. So the bundles, the sort of delta functions, well, actually, see, here this is a little bit confused because I said it's a function, so maybe we should be calling this delta sub Q1 and delta sub Q2. And functions which are non-zero only here. So these things are orthogonal basis, and if they are equal, you get 1 over size of the automorphisms of Q if Q1 is isomorphic to, whoops, Q2. And then another way of restating the thing in the box is that Z of a three-manifold is an element of the Hilbert space of its boundary. And then finally, why do we go to the trouble of doing all this? Well, because we can express gluing Fourier for three manifolds, and one simple instance of that is if we have three manifolds M1 and M2, and we cut along some surface Y, then Z of M1 union along Y, M2 is equal to the inner product of Z of M1 and Z of M2. So this is inner product lives in Z of Y. These are the okay, so I'm probably a lot of lectures used to be proving that such a thing exists. Now we could do it directly. I mean, we've pretty much given explicit formulas for what these things are. We just need to show that, you know, this gluing formula holds and things like that. But instead, I'm going to do it a little bit more indirectly, but it's going to use a technique that works in much more general circumstances. So we're going to think of these finite group TQFTs as sort of a warm up for more interesting TQFTs, and that's, you know, sort of the viewpoint of the Friedan-Quinn paper, you know, just emphasizing the formal properties. But I should know that the properties I've listed, that's all we need to know for the proof that Mike gave last week to work. So I have my notes reviewing what we had to know there, but maybe it's better not to take the time to. Anyone want to vote? Do I need to remind people why we care about that in the context of last week's lecture, or just forge ahead and show that these things exist? Okay, I'm going to forge ahead. Let's get that part. Okay, so how do we show that these things exist? Well, first, we want to switch our point of view from G bundles to maps into a classifying space. Because when you... It just becomes less tricky. If you were to go home and try to do some computations based on what I've told you so far, you would see that there's maybe some ambiguity. For example, suppose that we have, we take M and this equation to be S2 cross I. Okay, so up to isomorphism, there's a unique, you know, this is a simply connected space. There's a unique G bundle on it, and unique G bundles on the boundary. So we have only one choice for Q. And so then, what does this come out to be? Well, the possible answer, you know, one thing you might think is one. There's only one P, which restricts to here. But notice that I wrote equals here rather than isomorphic to. And so we actually want it. An explicit isomorphism. So if we draw S2, here's S2 cross I. You know, we should think that there's sort of base points here, and we also have to get the whole anomaly of the bundle from here to here. And this can be any element, little g and g. So there's actually cardinality of g of such things. That's the way we count. So that's maybe a little bit counterintuitive, and so we'll avoid such confusion if we start thinking in terms of classifying spaces. So I guess we should recall that P sub G.
Saying that you have the trivial bundle sitting on the two sides, and there wouldn't be an extension.
Well, I guess what does it mean? What is it if I have two different bundles over here? What does it mean to be isomorphic? Well, they're equipped. I said these are bundles whose restriction to the boundaries is equal to 2Q, not isomorphic, but equal to. That means they come with a given isomorphism to Q, And then any automorphisms of the bundle have to restrict to the identity there. So it's really, I guess, the way of, you know, so up to isomorphism, we have Qs sitting over this thing, and that's given by some map. But here, there's sort of G different isomorphisms, you know, this trivial bundle on this side. Mm-hmm. And each of those, and there's no, I mean, it's equivalent to choosing base points, but it's, anyway, I prefer not to explain it too much because, you know, the one of, you know, we get into, it gets confusing thinking in terms of bundles, at least for me. And so we would do better to think of maps into classifying spaces. So just recall that isomorphism classes of G bundles over a space X are sort of in natural bijection with a set of all maps from X into classifying space BG. Do I have to say what a classifying space is?
Yes.
Okay, there's some magic space, I will in just a moment, there's some magic space BG associated to G with the following property, that if we consider all maps from X into BG divided out by homotopy, and so I guess there's another way to say we take pi zero of this space, that this is a natural bijection. Okay, so what is BG? Well, it's the base, there's a bundle, EG, which is a principal G bundle. And it has the property that EG is contractible. All the homotopy groups are zero. And just use, that's the sort of defining fact of a classifying space. And then it's fairly straightforward to prove that we have this bijection between G bundles and this homotopy set. Some examples, so the way you construct a thing is you find some contractible space which has a free G action. And so BZ2, that, at, so EZ2 can be S infinity inside R infinity, and it has a, and this is a contractible, you know, contractible space, and so we mod out by Z2, and this is RP infinity. And I don't know. I guess the specifics aren't going to concern us that much. And there's a sort of given any finite group or any Lie group for that matter, there's a way of constructing such things. Okay, so now our field instead of... Okay, yeah, so C, so B, BU1 is CP infinity. BSU2 is HP infinity, infinite quaternionic projective space. Okay, so our initial idea, the digraphical Witten, is that we have these fields which are these G bundles. And so now we're going to take our fields, putting in a quote because I'm not telling you exactly what I mean by a field. I'm going to curly C of a manifold. Some dimension is equal to the set of all maps from X into BG. And I don't mean, and here I mean all maps, not all maps up to homotopy, but just all maps. So that's a very big space. But then we put a very big equivalence relation on it. So. We have a local relation on the space of fields. We say that F1 is equivalent to F2. equivalent to F2. So F, both of the Fs lie in here. If and only if F1 is homotopic. F2. So we have this big infinite dimensional space of modulus equivalence relation. It turns out there's only finitely many such things, just as there are only finitely many isomorphism classes of G1s. Okay, and then I guess just an aside is for a lot of what I'm talking about, it holds as long as we've got something, some fields with some very easily verifiable formal properties under gluing, and some kind of local relation, then the whole machinery proceeds forward. So, I'll just do the specific case of G bundles, but pretty much, you know, any well-behaved TQFT in low dimensions at least can be constructed in the same way, just using a different set of fields and a different local relation. And if there's time, I could say more about that at the end. Excuse me?
Fields would reset arbitrary maps from X to BG?
Continuous.
Yeah,
continuous. Yeah. Yeah, so we always have to at least be that. Okay, and so our strategy is going to. So notice that the TQFT, I didn't write down on some formal axioms, but it has this sort of top-dimensional part, three-dimensional part in our case, you know, these path integrals, but it also has these Hilbert spaces, a two-dimensional part. And then it's actually got some fancier one- and zero-dimensional parts that have to do with cutting surfaces and gluing, describing locality there. And so my strategy is going to be to start at this in the two-dimensional part and then work our way from there up and down. You know, these are sort of the easiest things to understand. And then we construct a path integral, and then we also construct these, you know, cylinder categories and particle representations and stuff like that. We do if we have time. Okay, so what? So before I define the Hilbert space as functions on fields, it's going to be convenient to have both that and its dual space, you know, just a linearized version of fields or functions. And so let's, a couple of definitions. We define A, which we should think of as dual to Z of a two-manifold, maybe with some boundary condition. Yeah, so let me quickly list some of the formal properties of this field functor that we're going to use. One is that there's a restriction map from C of X to fields on boundary of X. And then given a little c, which is a field on boundary of X, we can define fields on X with boundary conditions given by C as our inverse of C. And so usually when you have a manifold with boundary, you want to always oppose a boundary condition. So this is a more useful thing rather than all fields on X, if X has boundary. C of the empty set, we just define that to be a point. Fields on the disjoint union of X and Y are the product. And then more generally, we have a push-out diagram, or maybe it's pullback. We have fields on X union along some.
Sorry, Kevin, what does C of empty set equal to point
mean? We just. I'm defining this C goes from manifolds to sets. And so for the empty manifold of any dimension, it should give you a one point set.
Which is the empty set of the example of interest?
Excuse me?
Which is the empty set of the example of interest, right? The principal G bundle over the empty surface is the
empty.
I guess. I don't. but if you think about, you know, what would it take for this to be true if y is empty? Then we better have c of y be a 1.7. So it's just, this is just a formality to make our formulas come out true even in these edge cases. Okay, suppose we take x and y and we glue them together along some common subset S. Think of S as maybe some submanifold of the boundary of x and y. Well, we know from what we said above that we have restriction maps from C of x and C of S. Well, it doesn't, this is an incomplete set of axioms, so it doesn't quite follow, but certainly in the case of a concrete case we're considering where C of x is the maps in the classifying space, we have these restriction maps, and then we can take the fibered product, and this should be, you know, equal here. So when I say, you know, fields should behave well in their gluing, this is what I mean. And the point is that this is sort of an easy condition to verify, nothing fancy going on here. Okay, so now back to defining this dual to our Hilbert space. This is defined to be finite linear combinations of fields on Y with boundary condition C. Modulo our local relation. So we just, if we just F1 is both a field and we can think of it as a very simple finite linear combination of fields. And we just say F1 is equal to. So it's, you know, the obvious equivalence relation coming from our local relation here. And in other words, we take maps in the classifying spaces up to homotopy and we allow finite C linear combinations of them. And then dually, we can define Z between manifolds with boundary conditions given by C. Be a set of all maps I from fields on Y with the complex numbers such that if F1 is equivalent to F2, then that implies that phi of F1. So just functions on this mapping space which are constant on the homotopy classes. More generally, you could ask for functions which vary according to some three-cos cycle on here, and that gives you the twisted versions of the theories, but I don't want to go into that. Okay, so So now we could the two directions we could go from here is examine how these spaces behave under cuttings of surfaces, which I think is the more interesting direction, or we could try to construct this path integral, which is the direction that's more relevant to what Mike was talking about. So I think I'll do the more relevant thing first, and if time allows, talk about cutting these spaces. Okay, so what do we want? What are the formal properties that we want our path integral to have? Well, it should live. So given some three-manifold, we want to produce a vector in the Hilbert space associated to its boundary. And it should satisfy a gluing formula, which I'm going to write down carefully and explicitly and in some generality because we're going to be using it over and over again. So we want to consider not just the simple case of constructing a closed manifold out of two pieces, but we want to do gluing with corners. So we want, you know, the most general sort of gluing of three manifolds. So if we have say our M cut three manifold and boundary of let's go here uneven cut is decomposes into three pieces. W2 union Y union negative Y, where this is plus or minus Y are these two pieces here, and then W is everything else. So we're going to glue along the Ys, and then W is what's left over. And we glue, and we get glued. Boundary of M glued is some gluing of W. And then we also, let's call this common bound. Let's say that boundary of Y is S. It's going to be some one manifold S. Here's another copy of S. And let's fix some field or boundary condition on S. And then we can also pick a field, call it F cut, which is, lies on W. The boundary condition is given by C and the orientation reverse part of C. So what does that mean? We fix our map in the classifying spaces along this circle and that circle. And then we consider some extension over this part of the boundary W. And then that means we get some field over here, which is the gluing along C of our cut field. Okay, so that's the setup. And let's make F, instead of just a field, let's let it be a linear combination. So we'll write A. Yes, remember A is just linear combinations of fields. So what do we want to calculate? We want to calculate Z of M glued in terms of Z of M cut. That's what the gluing formula should tell us. So what is Z of M glued? Well, it lives in the Hilbert space for its boundary, which can be thought of as, I should have noted up here that Z of Y is the dual space A of Y. In other words, we can think of, if we've got an element of Z of Y, it's a function from this thing to C. So Z of the glue manifold is a function from A of boundary of M cut, boundary of M glued, into complex numbers. And we can evaluate it on this element here. It's a typical element. So Z of M glued evaluated on the gluing of some map F. Okay, so what's that going to be equal to? So if we can calculate this, that's sort of everything we'd want to know about the partition function. Well, it's going to be the sum over I of Z of M cut evaluated on, well, we can try to evaluate it on F cut, and that's specifying a field on part of the boundary of M cut, but we have these two pieces here corresponding to Y that are sort of newly exposed and open. We need to plug something in there before we can evaluate Z. And what do we plug in? Well, we basically sum over an orthogonal basis. So let's let EI be orthogonal basis of A of Y with boundary conditions given by C. So the linearized fields associated with Y with this boundary condition we've got. And so we can take EI and then the sort of orientation reverse version of EI. So we glue these three things together. Now we've got something that lies in boundary of M. So this expression makes sense. And then we have a normalizing factor of 1 over the inner product of EI with itself.
Did we have an inner product on A?
Not yet. So So what we want, I'm saying this is, I'm sort of writing down, I guess, basically the axioms for this three-dimensional part of our TQ of T. And we have these path integrals, and so the three-dimensional part consists of these path integrals, which I've just defined, and then inner products on A, which make this thing come true. So, other things we want are inner product on A of Y2, and C for all two manifolds, Y2. So this looks a little bit complicated, but it's sort of the only reasonable thing you could write down for gluing manifolds together. And this, there's probably more elegant, you know, subscript-free ways of writing this. We're really just taking some kind of trait. We assume we have these inner products on A, and then these dual spaces Z inherit the inner products, and we're really just taking a trace map for gluing them together. But this concrete form is the most useful for doing calculations. And if it follows, a sort of consequence of this is the fact that we can express the inner product in terms of the path integral, that if X and Y are in A of some two manifold with some boundary condition, the inner product of X and Y is equal to the path integral of Y thickened up into a three manifold evaluated on X bar union Y. So these are our main two things. And so to prove the existence of this pair of things, you know, the path integral and these inner products, we're going to go through an inductive argument, sort of alternating back and forth between using these formulas, and then show that, and we're going to do that based maybe on a Handel decomposition of a three-manifold, and we'll show it didn't depend on the particular Handel decomposition. So again, just to give a preview, if we knew the path integral of this three-manifold, then that gives us the inner product on Y. If we know the inner product on Y, that means we can calculate gluing along such a Y. And then that allows us to calculate path integrals for a bigger class of three-manifolds, which gives us more inner products, which allows us to do more general gluing. And we're going to eventually get everything. And this technique we're going to use actually works in any dimension for any set of fields and local relations that satisfy these sort of innocuous axioms. So this is a special case of a very general theorem for constructing TQ of T's out of sort of local relation sort of stuff. So still five, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, so let's start calculating. Even though I said it works in general, I'm going to be keeping at least one foot in our specific example of maps into classifying spaces. Okay, so what's the simplest three-manifold? It's the three-ball. So let's try to figure out what Z of the three-ball is. Well, where does it live? It lives in Z of the two-sphere, and that's a one-dimensional space for this particular theory because S2 is simply connected. So we don't have much choice. A sort of convenient choice of basis vector, and here's what I call E sub S2, and that's just a constant map. Constant map which sends S2 to some base point in BG. Well, actually, I guess that's an A of this too. So we'll know everything we need to know about Z of B3 if we can evaluate it on this very simple map. So this two, what is that equal to? Well, it's some, we can pick some arbitrary constant number lambda. Eventually we'll decide it's convenient to set lambda equal to 1. But it's sort of, it's a good way of making sure we're going to carry lambda through the calculations. So. But any choice of lambda would work. So we're just asserting, basically our starting point for this inductive argument is you say, okay, we're just going to stipulate what the path integral of the three ball is as a vector in the Hilbert space associated to its boundary. And Hilbert space is one-dimensional, so we really don't have much choice, and so on.
So somehow you're using that pi 2 of bg is 0.
In this case, yeah.
I mean, otherwise you might have other maps to worry about.
Right, yeah. So it turns out that this, in other more general theory, it's often the case that this is one-dimensional in those interesting theories it is. But if it's not, then yeah, you've got a bigger set of cases. But in those cases, the theory kind of breaks down into a sum of different pieces. So somehow, if you're in a theory where this space is bigger than one-dimensional, it's really a sum of simpler theories with this property.
Just to clarify this, is the statement that for any finite group G, BG has no two series?
Yeah, I guess I should have pointed that out. I mean, it follows from what I said, but the ith homotopy group of BG is 0 if I is bigger than, greater than or equal to 2. And it's G for I equal 1. And I guess it's just, you know, 1 for like 0. So it's connected space whose fundamental group is our finite group G, and all higher homotopy groups vanish. That follows, you know, I wrote down the vibration of EG over BG, and then there's a long exact sequence of homotopy groups from the vibration. EG is contractible.
And what does that notation mean? Z of B3 acting on E of S2?
Yeah, so recall that for any theorem that called Z of M lies in, you know, Z of boundary of M, which is the dual space, the A of boundary of M. So Z of boundary of M is functions on fields. That's basically what I've written here. And so that means we can take this path integral and evaluate it on a field. And so then I've given one particular thing here.
Z is pretty overloaded.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
You know, from a physics perspective, we can think of Z of M as the wave function. And if given a field, it gives you the conflict.
I see.
I mean, the place where you've changed the notation from the standard one that people might be used to is that would have been Z of N contained in V of boundary, right?
Yeah. And the motive, I mean, the main reason I think for the purposes of this lecture, I could have just as well used V. It probably would have been better, except I'm so used to writing Z, I probably would have started making mistakes. And the motivation for using one letter is that we actually have, you know, if you had a, you know, 7 manifold, you would need 7 different letters for what the path integral does in 7 different codimensions. So when you talk about the sort of general, more algebraic properties of these things.
Well, that's why it's good you're doing low dimension, isn't it?
Yeah. But even in dimensions 3 or 4, every letter you can save, you know. Okay, so we've... So what have we done so far? We've just stipulated what the path integral of the three ball is, but we don't think we've gone wrong so far because there really wasn't much choice. So if there's any path integral at all, it has this form. So we haven't burned any bridges. Okay, so what? So now let's use, call these things 1 and 2. So let's use 2 for y a disk, and we're going to compute what the inner product is on a. So if you have the space A of the two discs with some boundary condition, which let's just leave it arbitrary. I can't decide what I want. Actually, I think I'm going to, this curve bounds a disk, so we might as well assume it's sort of a constant map. I'm going to call that boundary condition E, which sends a circle to our base point inside the classifying space. And then up to homotopy, there's some unique thing I'll call E sub D2 in here, and we want to know what the inner product of E sub D2 with itself is. And that's equal to Z of D2 cross I, I have it on E sub D2, R union E sub D2. But D2 cross I is equal to V3, and these are, you know, let's just take these to be constant maps, and you glue them together, and you get this other constant map from S2. So this is equal to E sub S2, so this whole thing is equal to that. Okay, so the next step should be slightly less trivial. So now, okay.
Kevin,
so,
why does it say lambda equal 1 in parentheses there sometimes?
That eventually, for the to get the theory that I was talking about, it will set lambda.
So now it's lambda, but eventually it will be.
Yeah, eventually. When I started, writing the notes, I was guessing that I was going to have to set lambda equal to 1 over g, you know, the size of g. Turns out that was wrong, so maybe I should never mention lambda. But in other circumstances, it's good practice to carry it through. Okay, so we know z of the 3 ball, we know the inner product on disks, so that means we can glue three manifolds together along disks, and so if we take this picture not as a literal picture rather than a schematic picture, in other words, we're taking this D2 cross I, we're gluing it up to get S1 cross D2, we can compute that, so let's do that next. So Z of S1 cross D2, now we need to evaluate it on some fields, and so the I'm sort of reusing this picture here, the specific thing, to specify, you know, this map on the. So in general, to give a map into the class, to specify a map into the classifying space of a finite group, up to homotopy, we just have to tell for each element in the one skeleton what element of the group it goes through. So let's say this meridian goes to some element M and longitude goes to L, where M and L are elements of our finite group G. So I'll just call that field M, comma L. Okay, so what's that equal to? Well, if M is not equal to 1, the trivial element in G, then we're going to be looking at this space A of, where is it? These E's, you know, live in A of Y comma C. So if Y is the disk and C is some non-trivial element of G, then this is a zero-dimensional vector space. So we get 0 if it's not equal to 1. And if M is equal to 1, then we've got two terms, this and this. This gives us lambda, and this gives us 1 over lambda. So. M cut is a 3 ball, and we evaluate on this field, which is going to be this sort of trivial thing. And so it's the lambda comes from this, and the 1 over lambda comes from that one. More general, we're not going to need it, but if we had Z of a handle body of genus G evaluated on some MI, comma, LI, so on. And this is equal to 0 sum I is not 1, and it's equal to lambda to the 1 minus g all. But again, we're not going to use that directly. Okay, so now we can calculate. And I guess I should have said, once we know the center product for disk, we know how to calculate gluing a one handle to a three manifold. So the next thing we want to do is glue on a two handle. What's the attaching region of a two handle? It's an annulus. And so we need to know the inner product for an annulus. To know the inner product for an annulus, we need to know the path integral for annulus cross I. What's annulus cross I? Well, it's the same as S1 across DS2. So it's what we just computed. So we're in a position now to calculate that inner product. I'm just going to draw.
In conventional terms, is there some kind of asymmetric going on here? You're making the torus in one direction and they're using it in the other?
I guess, though, it's not. I think maybe some small piece of the S matrix is getting used, like maybe the first row or something like that. Because we're all, these curves are always bounding a disk. So let's say U is the sort of holonomy from there to there. L is the holonomy around these ends, L. The fact that I'm just going to assume they're both L. This is V, L. So this inner product is equal to 1 if U is equal to V, 0 if U is not equal to V. So in other words, given if we take a field on an annulus, we fix what it is on the boundary of the annulus, and then we have a choice of on this here. It's the commutator of U and should be equal to 1, also B. So once we fix it on the boundary, there are choices of the holonomy or things which commute with L, and that gives some orthonormal basis for that vector space.
Sorry. Somehow the two inside and outside of the annulus are supposed to be mapping to the identically to the classifying space?
Yeah, I just stipulated. I mean, I could consider a more general case, okay. but that's the case that I'll need.
But that's the reason we see a commutator relation.
Yeah. So I think I'm going to speed up a little bit so that this doesn't get too tedious. But feel free to slow me down if you want. But if you're bored, then you shouldn't say anything, and I'll get through it more quickly. Okay, so now we know the inner product on an annulus, we're in a position to glue two handles. So one particular thing we could do is Z of S2 cross I, which we think of as D2 cross I union D2 cross I, and this union is along S1 cross I, the annulus. And again, we apply this formula. So the cup manifold consists of two different three balls. So that gives us, what are we going to evaluate it on? We need we need fields on the boundary. The boundary is a pair of two spheres, so we might as well assume it's a trivial map, which I called E sub S2. Disjoint union E sub S2. This term gives us a lambda squared. And then we have to sum over this basis, and we'll be summing over the case where L is equal to 1. And so the things which commute, so that means anything in U and V, U in this case, could be any element of G. So we're gonna have G terms in the sum, and then this factor, 1 over the inner product of these things, is just going to be 1, because we said that this inner product is 1. So it all comes out to the size of G. Okay. And now the final thing we'd like to know how to do is, so far we've done the necessary homework for zero handles, one handles and two handles, and the last thing we need to do is three handles. So we need to know an inner product on this space, or A of S2. So we need to, know the inner product of E sub S2 with itself. And again, applying 2, we see that that's equal to Z of S2 cross I, evaluated on E sub S2 R. And so that's is equal to M squared G. So finally, maybe let's calculate some closed-through manifolds before trying to characterize in the general case. What about the three-sphere? Z of S3. So that's Z of 3. Thank you. Z of S3, which is Z of B3 union B3. We apply this formula. The Cub manifold is a pair of three balls, so we get a lambda squared. And then this term, this sort of correction term of the factors, it's going to be E sub S2 here. So this is times lambda squared G inverse, so it's equal to 1 over G. And notice that for this closed manifold, the answer doesn't depend on the choice of lambda. And that's basically boils down to the fact that for a closed three manifold, the Euler characteristic is zero. If you look back at everything I've written, lambda, it sort of comes in. The exponent of the lambda is the Euler characteristic of the manifold we're talking about.
So you go over first where those two lambdas can be?
Okay, so this B3 gives a factor of lambda. This B3 gives another factor of lambda. So that's these two.
Sorry, what is it?
Well, so I'm applying this formula. So maybe I should just write it out explicitly. So if we just take formula number 1, and we have sum over I, there's only going to be one term in the sum. Z of the 3 ball, disjoint union of 3 ball, that's in cut. Mm-hmm. Times 1 over the inner product of, so we're summing over just one element, which is this E sub S2. And so then we take 1 over E sub S2, comma, S2. So this term is this. This term is that. You look confused.
Where's the lambda squared inside the parentheses?
The inner product of E sub S2 with itself is lambda squared times. If we want to check, eventually we want to show that we get that same answer that I wrote down initially, in terms of G bundles and the size of their automorphisms groups. So how many G bundles are there over the three sphere? Well, there's only one. And how big is this automorphism group? Well, it's all of G, so it's effective 1 over G. So far we're doing okay. You can also calculate Z of S1 cross S2. So again, we'll have a sum just over one term E sub S2. I'm going to cut it where the cut manifold is S2 cross I times, of course, this factor. And in this case, Z of S2 cross I, you know, evaluated on these S2s. So this is just lambda squared G times 1 over lambda squared G is equal to 1. Of course, we also could have argued, you know, more generally that this should be the dimension of the Hilbert space associated to S2, which is one-dimensional. But unfortunately, we get the same answer when we compute it this way. Okay, so now, what about a general free manifold? Well, okay, actually, first I should say, so far we haven't even proven that this path integral of these properties exists. We've sort of done some calculations for some simple manifolds. If we had a big manifold that had, you know, didn't have, well, you know, we could take even these manifolds and give them a different Handle decomposition. How do we know we would get the same answer? And it turns out it's not too hard to show that you do when it boils down to. So we've got this three manifold. We're building it up out of, you know, handles in various ways. Each handle by itself is, you know, homeomorphic to a three ball. I don't want to get too bogged down in proof, but it just, you know, given three of these things, you can interchange the order and you get the same answer, and that's what it comes down to. So particularly, we're not checking invariance under, you know, Pockner moves of triangulations. We're not checking invariance under this Dane surgery stuff the way these combinatorial proofs for three manifolds often go. So it's sort of a different, simpler combinatorial technique.
You don't need to check some kind of superior for the decomposition? I mean, I think the natural argument would be to relate the decompositions one to the other by moves.
Yeah, I guess you are, but it's just candle cancellation is all you have to check. So at this point, I'm sort of going quickly over this. Once we've done this proof that I sketched right here, we know that this Z does exist and it satisfies all these properties, but we don't yet have this nice formula that I wrote down at the beginning of the lecture in terms of G bundles. So what I want to do at the end is show that this thing we define in a very non-explicit way, just, you know, take your three manifold, chop it up in terms of handles, apply these formulas, and I don't know what the answer is, but you'll get the same answer no matter how you do it. That's what we've done so far. Now we want to characterize it in terms of G bundles and automorphism groups. So the first claim, and also, I'm going to set lambda equal to 1 from now on. So I'll say M is connected. Boundary of M is non-empty. And Z of M evaluated on some F, so F is going to be a map from boundary M into BG. Is equal to the cardinality of the set of all big F from M into BG, such that big F restricted to boundary of M is equal to little f. So that's consistent with what I wrote down before in terms of bundle extensions, except just translated into classifying spaces. So how do we prove that? Actually, I guess rather than assuming M is connected,
set up the homotopy.
No. Yeah, up to that should be pi zero of this topological of the space of nodes. Thanks. Instead of M connected, I guess it just M has no closed components. So the first step of the proof is if it's if the statement is true for M1 and M2 implies it's true for M1 to start union M2. It's true for M the 3-ball. So it's true for M implies it's true for M union of one handle. So that's a little bit. Let's see what I want to say. What do I want to say about that? Well, it's. I just leave it as an. We've given very explicitly how to glue one handles on, and so we just check both sides, and it's, you know, well, it's just a matter of understanding the definitions. There's nothing more to it. And similarly, same when we glue on the two handle. So that's enough. Okay, so for manifolds. For non-closed manifolds and disjoint unions of them, what this says is that, you know, another way of saying this, we take, you know, this little f is some basis vector in our Hilbert space, or is dual to a basis vector. What's the component of M there? Well, it's just the number of extensions, little map f. In particular, this is the fact that Mike was using last week. If there are no extensions, then the component is zero. And if there exist extensions, then it's non-zero because there's no, we're sort of, you know, summing these as a coefficient one. They're not going to cancel each other out. So that's the property that really was used in my proof.
By the way, that implication here, does the proof show an equivalence? The implication in both directions.
Oh.
I'm just thinking then. D would be a formal consequence of C.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I hadn't thought of that. Probably it does, but I'm not sure. Well, I don't know. I think there might be some. Yeah, I think you're right that the C and D together are the same as making this if and only if, but it's the same proof either. Yeah, they're so closely related that you're not really saving any work. Okay, so finally, let's say if M is closed and connected, And then Z of M is equal to 1 over G times a set of homomorphisms from pi 1 of M into G, which we observed earlier is the same as sum over G principal bundles over M of 1 over automorphisms of P. So the equivalence here, again, is just like a counting argument, is that this formulation is what we're going to make contact with. And what we're actually using, so this factor of G that appears here is this, because we know, so let's look at the gluing formula. Let's express M, the closed manifold, as a punctured M union of 3-ball. Let's see how this implies that. I'll do it over here. So Z of M Z of M minus B3 times Z of B3 times 1 over G. So this term is our Z of M cut. We cut M along a two-sphere, and we get these two pieces, and then it's multiplicative under disjoint union. And then this term is 1 over the inner product of the basis vector that we stick on the two-sphere, which is here. Remember, we've set lambda equal to 1. Okay, and these should both be evaluated on E sub S2. Okay, well, the 3-ball value in ES2, that's just equal to lambda, which we've set to 1, so we can cross that term out. And what's this? Well, this is the number of extensions. So we've got E sub S2, that's a map from the 2-sphere, the boundary of punctured M, into the base point of the classifying space. And now we're counting all the extensions of that map into from M into BG up to homotopy. Well, that's exactly, extension is exactly a homomorphism of pi 1 of M into G, because we've got the base point there. So it's just sort of basically, it follows from our previous statement that this term gives us the number of homomorphisms from pi 1 into M, and then we have this correction factor from the gluing. And then the counting argument means we can rearrange the sum into summing over the, the consciously classes of homomorphisms by this factor. So we're almost done with this. Okay, so to review what we've done, we've started out, we've taken kind of a roundabout route to showing this ring. I emphasize we could have just taken this formula as a definition and then shown that it satisfies the gluing axioms. Instead, we sort of systematically assumed all the gluing axioms held, and we tried to deduce what the path integral had to be. And we showed how it behaves under Handel's addition. We showed that allows us to give a combinatorial definition of the path integral, though not a very explicit one. And now we've identified it for this particular case of this TQFT based on G bundles as this kind of formula. And the only thing that's missing is I haven't given you the inner product for surfaces yet, because I wrote down that too. And is there time? Should I do that, or do you want to just go home? Okay. Yeah, I think. Okay. So what? So what's the inner product on surfaces? So first consider the case where boundary of Y is not empty. Let's say Y is connected, or at least has no closed components. then Y cross I is a handle body of some genus. What is it? H.
No. So it's a 1
in the body.
So, yeah, so a picture, I guess, would be. So here's a punctured torus drawn in a funny way. And if we just make this thick, we can kind of, it's clearly just a genus 2 handle body. And so how do we describe, so what's the, we want to define some typical element of A of Y with boundary conditions given by C. Let's see some boundary. Let's assume that away from, say, a little place here, this maps to the base point in BG. We could take C to be the constant map. That's going to be the most interesting case. But it's assumed that all these things go to the base point. And then for each of these sort of two-dimensional one handles here, we can draw an arc and we get elements, you know, in G, in the I's. So that's enough to describe a map from Y into BG with our given boundary condition. And now if we want to take the inner product of a bunch of AIs with a bunch of BIs, well, I guess earlier I wrote down a formula for a handle body. I said we weren't going to need it, but I was wrong. I guess we do need it here. But it basically, when we thicken it up, we're going to put one set of fields on the top and one on the bottom. Again, we're applying this formula right here. We take the inner product of two elements. We look at the three-manifold we get by thickening our surface, and then we put one field on the top of this and one field on the bottom. And because these curves, the curve going around the top of this and then along the bottom, bound a disk, the curve around it has to be equal to 1. So this inner product is 0. Unless AI is equal to BI for all I. In other words, the bundles form an orthogonal basis. And if these are all equal, then it's equal to 1. Because remember, we've set lambda equal to 1.
Didn't you only label half the...
Yeah, the other half doesn't matter. Oh, well, I see. I think it's not orthogonal. No, the other half is given that's because we specified. Yeah, no, I labeled both halves. Like for a torus, I've got two elements of G.
Oh.
It's a little bit non-standard the way I've labeled it. Yeah, then you cut, once you've specified this, everything left over is a disk. So we're okay. So yeah, so these numbers completely specify the map up in the classifying space up to homotopy, and different maps are orthogonal. In fact, it's an orthonormal basis. And so I think that's part of, so because in this case, we wanted the inner product of two bundles. I think the formula I wrote down before was, and a product of Q1 and Q2, where these are bundles over Y, is equal to 0 if they're non-isomorphic. It's this part. If they're isomorphic, we get 1 over automorphisms of Q. But in this case, because we've got no close components, there's no automorphisms. This is 1. So okay, so far. So the final case is a closed surface. Which is maybe the most fun case. okay, so Y closed. And let's assume connected. So we want to take this case and then glue a two handle onto it. So here is Y minus a disk cross I. It's got this annulus on its boundary, and then we're gluing to it E2 cross I. And these two, of course,
these two together, if we glue them, we get y cross I, which is exactly what we need to plug into this formula to compute the inner product. So to specify, so how do we specify this x and y, which are maps from the closed surface into the classifying space? Well, it's no harm in assuming that this disk goes to, the map's just constant on this disk. So we apply this case here where the C is equal to the constant map. And so again, we see that if we have non-isomorphic bundles on the top and the bottom, it follows from what we did for the surface of the boundary that we're going to get zero. So the orthogonality is true. So now we just have to nail down that factor. And we want to see that it comes out to be 1 over the automorphisms of Q, which is, will actually be an interesting number at this point. So how do we do that? Okay, so let's rewrite. So this is a surface of boundary cross I, and I want to rewrite it like this. And let me draw a more suggestive picture. So this curve is meant to be this guy here, but we're actually taking a cross I. So that's a little piece of punctured y cross I. And along the top, we have some curve, you know, AI. And on the bottom, this little rectangle, we also have AI, because we're taking the inner product of two things. We've already handled the case where these are not equal. And then, we're applying this gluing formula to compute. I'm sorry, we need to compute the path integral of a closed surface cross I. And to do that, we take the punctured surface cross I and we glue on a two handle. So we apply, when we glue along a two handle, we're applying this formula in the case where y, the surface we're gluing along, is an annulus. And remember that the annulus has a basis. The basis for an annulus consists of elements, let's call it h, from here to here, that commute with the holonomy around here. But the holonomy around here is trivial. So h is something over all elements of G. So I'm going to see an h here and also an h there on this rectangle. So just review, we've got AI, AI, H, H. Suppose if the commutator of H and AI is not 1, then we're going to get 0 because there's no way to fill that in. You know, it's just means the bundle on the boundary doesn't extend over the 3 manifolds, so the path integral for that component goes to 0. And so the only H's that are going to count are the ones which commute with the AIs for all I. So the sum here, which was initially over all H and G, becomes a sum of this summation. You should think of it as this summation over here over the basis vectors on the annulus that actually give a non-zero contribution. Summing over all H such that H commutes with AI for all I. Remember, the AIs were the polynomials describing the bundle on the surface. Well, an H which commutes with all those, this set is exactly the automorphisms of the associated bundle. I mean, we've got some element of G which commutes with everything in the surface automorphism. And so what have we proved? That means that each term in this sum is going to be 1. We end up showing that the inner product we're computing comes out to be the number of automorphisms of Q. You might say, one and one over automorphisms Q, we're getting the inverse of that. Well, this was the inner product for elements of A. And remember, it was the same mistake I made before. I said this is the inner product of the bundles, but it's really the inner product of the delta functions associated to the bundles. And that just, you know, the diagonal metric, you know, because the inverse. So that's how we derive that factor. So, oh, I guess I went a little bit over. Sorry. Let's see.
Yeah, I actually have a question and a comment. You didn't say much about the twisted case, but is it? Can you distinguish the different lens spaces with twisted finite group G50s?
I don't know. I've never thought. That's a good question. I've never thought about that. So,
so the comment, which is sort of a great problem, I think, for the audience, is. You know, I mentioned in one of my talks that three-manifold group theories are finite. It seems like a generalization of this might be that you can learn everything about the homotopy type of a three-manifold, which from by Perlman we know is just about the whole story by finite group theories. Do you think that's possible? In other words, it might be that if two three-manifolds have the same value on all finite group TPFTs, they're homotopy equivalent. Do you think that's reasonable?
Well, it's not.
Except for lens spaces.
Right? Except for lens, okay.
So let's just say hyperbolic lens.
Yeah, that seems, I mean, actually, if there's more time, I was going to write down a list of sort of similar questions about what, you know, similar open questions about what TKFTs in general, at least finite group TKFTs, can say. And that, yeah, it seems like, I don't know the answer, but it seems like it might be tractable.
It's sort of like the question of can you tell two groups apart by their homomorphisms to finite groups?
Yeah.
Thanks, Joe. Next week we're having a math physics happening starring Mike Friedman and Eva Thorstein. Together with the audience, they will explore what questions about free manifolds might be useful to stringy physics and might be known or addressable by mathematicians.